Last month, a scientist in China said that he used a gene editing technique called CRISPR on two babies, and that those babies have already been born.
The world has moved on to the stage for embryo gene editing. There will be someone somewhere who's doing this. If it's not me, it's someone else.
That's audio from the Wall Street Journal. We'll check in with U of I's Rachel Whitaker on what CRISPR is and why so many scientists are upset about how it's being used. Plus, 10 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized recreational marijuana. Is Illinois next in line? We'll dive into what's next if the legislature takes that issue up next year. And after 7 years, the publication Rookie Magazine has come to an end. Rookie was unapologetically teen girl-centric and featured contributors like 19-year-old Opasna Bharat.
I actually just started my first year of college. And I haven't learned much besides what I've learned in my classes. But what I have learned about is sex.
All that and more coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, is Illinois the next in line to legalize recreational marijuana? We'll break down some of the biggest questions around this issue as state lawmakers prepare to meet next month. And we'll also hear from readers of Rookie Magazine about what the publication meant to them. But first, it's been more than two decades since the film Gattaca hit the big screen. And at the time, designer babies, genetically manipulated to perfection, may have just seemed like a distant dystopian dream. But maybe that dream isn't so far away after all. Last week, news broke that a Chinese researcher is claiming to have created the world's first genetically edited human babies, two twin girls. According to the researcher, He Zhengkui, the twin genes have been modified to resist HIV infection by using a process called CRISPR. Some scientists praise the researcher, while others have denounced it as unethical. And now the Chinese government has said they are shutting down his research and launching an investigation. Joining me now for more on this is Rachel Whitaker. Rachel is a professor in the Department of Microbiology at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Rachel, I want to thank you for being here with me today, and welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we really get into the news of all of this, I was hoping you could help us, especially those of us lacking a science background, to understand what CRISPR is and how it works.
I can try. So CRISPR is the latest in a long history of inventions of microbes that are now being used by us to do engineering. There's many examples of this. By studying the biology of microorganisms, we've learned a lot about the machines they use in their cells. Just like us, microbes get infected by viruses. And just like us, they have immune systems to protect them against, to defend against virus infections. And so CRISPR was originally evolved as a system for bacteria and archaea to defend themselves against virus infection. And the way it works is that when a cell gets infected by a virus, just like us, it tries to fight off the infection. If it wins and is able to fight off the infection, at some frequency, sometimes, it will take a piece of the virus genome and put it in its own genome. And that makes a record of previous infections. Then it hands that record down to the next generation.
Okay.
So it's encoded in the genome a memory of this previous infection. Now that memory is in the genome. It acts as a flag for the next time the next cell or the next generation of cells is infected by the virus.
So it teaches it how to fight the virus, is what you're saying.
It remembers that specific virus.
Okay. So when you're talking about CRISPR, CRISPR was a micro, would you say the microbe, did you create the microbe then or no?
No, the microbes created this themselves or evolved it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this is how it was originally
discovered.
It was discovered in the microbes, in the genomes of microbes.
And you discovered that you could use this to help other cells fight viruses?
Okay. So this is one more step we need, which is that so this flag that's encoded in the genome then directs this amazing machinery to target the next infection. So it sees the next infection using this flag, remembers it, mm-hmm. and then deactivates the virus on the next infection.
But only for that virus, not all viruses.
Right. Okay. Exactly. It's very specific. Then that's important. for how we use it later. So it was...
I was going to ask, how have scientists then used it?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was discovered in the genomes, and for a while we had no idea how it was working. And then the discovery, the key discovery, was that we can use this. We now understand how that machine works, the machine that does the degrading of the invading element. And now we can create our own flags to target that machine to any genome we want.
Okay.
So basically take the machine and the flag out of the microbes and put it into any organism we want to target the genome in a living cell. So, I mean, it was designed as a defense. So you're not killing the cell to engineer it. You're just giving it the ability to make a mutation in a specific place that's determined by that flag sequence with this specific machine that will make deactivate a gene or activate a gene.
So the process to do all of this, would you say it is complicated or not complicated?
So it's amazing and elegant in its simplicity, I think, once we understand it, that it's really you need two pieces. You need the enzyme, the machine, the protein that does the makes a mutation in the gene, and you need the specific flag. And that's all you need. And so it's actually not that complicated to use. And so it's been used in many, 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 many different systems. Elephants, mice, microbes of all kinds, plants, and now humans.
So, yeah, it sounds like it's a game changer and there's a lot of potential there.
Absolutely.
And you were saying that you used in elephants and mice, but to just to fight off viruses or in any other way?
No, to make changes. So it can be used to make changes in the genome. So the genome has the instructions for all the proteins that we make. Sometimes those we want to change what those proteins are. And if we want to do that, we now just need to match that sequence to target the machinery to our own genome.
So CRISPR is not a new discovery per se based on what you're talking about. So what about last week and what happened in China was new?
So what was new was that, so like I said, it can be used in a living cell to make a genetic change in a living cell. And what they did last week was show that they used this in an embryo, and that living cell grew into a human. So it's not a new technology, but the application to a human germline, human cell, at the embryonic stage and it growing into a baby is the new part.
And it was, am I correct in saying that the researcher used it in just to fight one particular virus, correct?
Okay, so this is where it gets confusing.
Okay.
So we could make any changes in any genome that, you know, that you would want. But what he decided to do was to make a change in the immune system, in the immune cell of a human. So now we're using the immune cell of a microbe to change the immune system. But they're totally different. It's really just a change that's happening in the genome. And that genome, that gene happens to encode for a receptor for a human virus, which is the HIV virus.
So the research has not been published or vetted in a scientific journal. We want to be clear about that. So is there any way to prove that this was actually successful?
Definitely a way to prove that it was successful. They know exactly what to look for in the genome, but they would have to have an independent person, you know, do the genome sequencing and find the mutation that was made and see how many cells in the babies have been changed. And so far, he's the only one that's done this. He's presented the data, but nobody has independently seen the data themselves.
So do you happen to know why this Chinese scientist, his name is He Zhenkui, chose the HIV virus to alter?
I mean, I don't know him, but he didn't alter the virus. He altered the human receptor for the virus. And I think it was, at least the reports say, that it was because it provides resistance to HIV infection. And the father of the child was HIV positive.
Okay. That's a good context to be put into. I'm curious how you, as a scientist, someone who studied this, who's familiar with it, when the news broke last week, how did you feel?
I was surprised that it had got, I think everybody was, that it had gotten that far that fast. I think that everybody was surprised that someone would go ahead and show that this could be done. Partially, it was the choice of what gene to alter that's surprising, because there's other things, there's life-threatening diseases that could have been made changes. HIV, protecting against HIV can be treated in other ways, right? And now. And so this was, and we don't really know how this change in the immune system impacts other infections. You're changing your immune cells. And so that could have many different implications.
Like
there's
what?
Much more specific changes that could have been made that would change something in the human genome that is very clearly associated with a disease that could allow a child to live. So that seemed like a strange choice.
So there is a potential that by altering this one thing, you could have a cascade of effects that would be negative?
Yes.
Anything you could name in particular?
Well, you're changing your immune system. So there's a lot of ways that your immune cells interact with other infectious, you know, viruses or bacteria, but also the other cells in your body. And they've tried it apparently in mice and in monkeys, but never in a human. And the human immune system is pretty different from mice and monkeys.
So. A little more complicated.
Yeah.
So I gather from how you described CRISPR in the beginning of our conversation, you were excited about it initially as a scientist. Would you say that your feelings have changed now since last week?
No, I'm still really excited. I'm a microbiologist, so I'm still really excited about it as an immune system for microbes and what it can do for understanding and even treating infectious disease in microorganisms. It has lots of other applications that are really making a big impact. I think that being cognizant of that, the potential to impact humans, is something that the scientists should be doing, but that shouldn't decrease excitement about the technology.
So the questions of ethics have certainly come up, right? He's received a lot of backlash from his peers. So ethically speaking, what are your biggest concerns going down this path of potentially manipulating human DNA?
So I'm not an ethics researcher. I don't know very much about how these ethical principles are applied. But I think it's pretty important that the scientists be really clear about what we know and what we don't know to the people that are involved and to the community. So I think the ethics come in for this particular situation that it wasn't vetted before it was done.
Right.
And that could really have huge implications downstream. So we don't know in those particular babies how it's going to impact their life. But also, you know, he didn't get permission to do this from the global community of scientists. And I think that really has to happen.
So what is the right process? If you do want to go down this path, what should have happened? What should he have done?
Yeah, so people are really talking about that now. There's a lot of articles in our scientific journals about, you know, how can we prevent this kind of thing from happening? And part of it is that the scientists aren't necessarily qualified to be making all the choices, but we have to be clear about what we know and what we don't know. So in stem cell research, there were sets of guidelines that were set up when stem cell research first started, and people adhere to those guidelines, and new protocols have to be vetted based on those guidelines and vetted based on the, you know, downstream human implications of what the science is going to do. And so I think people are very quickly, this had already started. Some of the people that had been working on CRISPR had started thinking about what the guidelines should be. There's been plenty of meetings that have been talking about setting up these guidelines, but they're not in place yet. And so I think that is probably the thing we need to do right away.
Well, and I seem to remember with stem cell research, that was a long conversation. That didn't happen overnight. There was a lot of debate, even as a member of the public and not a member of the scientific community. I remember that going on for a long time. It's not like, hey, can I do this? And then someone says yes or no.
Exactly.
You have to go back and forth with that.
Yeah. And so, it has to be a global decision. It's not something that, you know, the United States can make one set of rules and China can make another set of rules. We all have to make the same set of international guidelines to follow.
Very important to note. So I'd like to end with this. What would you hope to see for the future of CRISPR?
I think those guidelines are going to be really important. People need to trust scientists to be thinking about the implications of what they're doing. Scientists shouldn't just go ahead and try it because they can, or even because they can save one life. We have to be clear about what we're doing and let the world know and let people that are, you know, able to make those decisions in a very, very with all of the different rules that are in place in mind and all the different implications in mind, or else people won't trust science. So CRISPR can go ahead, but I think with those guidelines in place.
We've been talking about a gene editing technique called CRISPR with Rachel Whitaker, a professor in the Department of Microbiology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you so much for being with us today, Rachel.
You're welcome. It was fun.
Coming up on the 21st, when it comes to the debate over whether to legalize recreational marijuana in Illinois, there's a lot to consider.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting a booth at the Urbana Holiday Market in the Square December 8th and December 15th, featuring regional and special interest titles for every book lover on your list. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. 10 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized recreational marijuana. 32 in total allow for medical marijuana. Illinois has already legalized the medical use and passed decriminalization, all within the past 5 years. And Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker has said he supports legalization. So is Illinois next in line? And if so, what would that look like? What questions would that raise for communities across the state? Earlier this week, we gathered reporters and residents for Illinois Newsroom's fourth News and Brews event. We brought together three journalists who might sound familiar to listeners of this show. Lee Gaines is a reporter with WILL and Illinois Newsroom. Ryan Dunham is a reporter with our partner station WGLT in Normal. And Christine Herman is a reporter with WILL and Side Effects Public Media. I spoke with them in front of a live audience at Riggs Beer Company in Urbana on Tuesday. And I asked Ryan to tell us what makes Illinois similar and what makes us different from the states that have already legalized recreational marijuana.
So Vermont actually earlier this year became the first state to legalize recreational marijuana through the legislature. So the way that we would do it, as you mentioned, it's other than them, it's been all through the referendums. Illinois does not have like that history of populism like the states like California have, where you turn to the ballot box to make giant public policy decisions. In Illinois, that's not even like legal. For statewide referendums are all advisory, right? So you could theoretically put an advisory question on a statewide vote to see, like, what does the public think of this? But generally, referendum statewide can only make, like, constitutional changes. They can't make statute changes like that.
So as we mentioned, Illinois did legalize medical marijuana back in 2013. So, Christine, I want to switch gears and move over to you. Who has access to it right now, and how do they get access?
Yes, so you have to apply to the Illinois Department of Public Health, and there's a list of conditions on their website, maybe about 30 or so. Some are like cancer or PTSD. Others are like smaller conditions that maybe only affect a smaller group of people. But you need to have a doctor certify that you have a qualifying condition, and then you can apply. So there are, I believe, latest I checked, almost 40,000 users in Illinois of the medical marijuana. It's a pilot program that's been extended a couple times, so I think it's effective through at least the end of next year. Some of the challenges I've heard from patients who have been trying to get access, it's not a prescription, but many doctors are still unwilling to sign the paperwork that just confirms that you have a qualifying condition. And so some people will, like, you know, kind of just try to search and find a doctor who will see them, who will certify their condition.
So it's not a prescription. It's not that
it's
you
not
need your doctor to say, yes, I think this is something that you need. Your doctor just needs to say, yes, you have one of these. I believe it might be 41 conditions.
Yes. Another thing is that it's not covered by insurance, since marijuana at the federal level is still illegal. You need to pay cash, and so that can also be a barrier for lots of people. It's the similar thing, you know, with what you hear about recreational. People will turn to the black market to get marijuana if they want to use it for a medical condition and they're not able to get legal access through the program we have.
So in your reporting, you've talked to patients that have used medical marijuana. How has it affected them?
There's lots of anecdotal stories out there, but I think I want to start by saying that there is a lot of research about medical marijuana for different conditions, and I like to look at the meta-analyses where there are, you know, scientists who've looked at 10,000 studies and then summarized where there's the strongest evidence. There's the strongest evidence for the use of medical marijuana for chronic pain, for multiple sclerosis, and for cancer, chemotherapy-induced nausea in particular. One of the most telling things about medical cannabis is when you hear from patients who may have been addicted to opioids or been dependent on high doses of chronic opioids for, like, a chronic pain condition. Well, marijuana, that's one of the conditions that has the strongest evidence for the use of medical marijuana. And so, yes, I met a patient who was able to sort of wean himself off of opioids through the use of medical marijuana. It's a drug, but it's a less addictive drug, and it's you can't overdose on marijuana. You'll hear that argument a lot. So if you can help a patient transition from an opioid to marijuana, and it also helps manage their pain, that's a potential benefit. And I've talked with patients for whom that's been a game changer for them.
So, Lee, one huge aspect of this debate is the criminal justice system. And as we know, for instance, arrests related to marijuana disproportionately affect communities of color. So historically, let's just go back and look at what that's looked like in Illinois.
The ACLU has done a lot of work looking at this. They published this report in 2013, and it looked at arrests between 2001 and 2010. And what they concluded was that blacks are almost four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than whites. In Illinois, blacks were more than seven times more likely to be arrested than whites. And actually, the only places where that disparity was greater was Washington, D.C. and Iowa.
Use is the same in both
groups, yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. The use, they did note that in their report, that the use among races is roughly equal. The justice system's enforcement of marijuana is touching people of color at far greater rates than white people. And so locally, a couple of years ago, I did some reporting on this in Chicago, where I FOIA'd the Chicago Police Department for their arrest data for 2016. So the takeaway from that was the overall number of arrests for marijuana possession, particularly low-level possession, so that's 10 grams or less usually, have steadily fallen. I think it was something like 22,000 arrests in 2011, and by the time I was looking at the data, it was closer to 3,000. The interesting thing about that, though, is that the racial breakdown remained the same. So in 2011, roughly 80% of the people arrested were African American, roughly 4% were white, the rest were Hispanic, and then that same racial breakdown was true in 2016 as well.
Christine, what do we know about the legalization of marijuana in the public health concerns?
Yeah, so always the concern, I think the natural concern, is that when you legalize a substance that it will lead to increased use and increased addiction, and that the benefits of the legalization would outweigh the potential risks. So it is still an addictive substance, and so there are some studies that have shown no increased use. So out of Colorado, if you look at the Colorado Department of Public Health's information, After legalizing, they have not seen increased use or frequency, but other studies have shown that in other places, and if you look in aggregate across the country, legalizing medical marijuana has led to increased use both among adults and among teens, which is obviously concerning. Marijuana does affect the developing brain up through age 25, which I feel like maybe a lot of people don't realize. It's not just kids. It's even into your 20s.
What makes it so hard to study marijuana and get answers to these really important questions when we're looking at should we do this or not?
So one is that it's hard to get long-term data when this is still a relatively new phenomenon. The other thing is something I mentioned, federally, it's classified as a Schedule I drug in the same class as heroin and LSD, which means that the Drug Enforcement Administration sees marijuana as having no medicinal benefit and being highly addictive. And so it's very hard to study a Schedule I drug. You can't use federal funding to study it. And so I mentioned there are thousands of studies out there, right? And there have been these meta-analyses. But you'll hear some people, especially on the anti-marijuana side, saying there's no research that shows it's effective for anything. And what they mean is there's no the gold standard of scientific evidence, the clinical trials where they have large groups of people and there's a control group and a experimental group, and then they look at outcomes over time. Yes, those are the studies that are lacking. Those are also the studies that are very, very hard to do. I've talked to some researchers who've told me about the hoops they have to jump through to try to get approval to study marijuana, not just the risks, but also the potential benefits. So it's this catch-22 where you can't study it, so then the federal government says we can't reclassify it until there's evidence that it's beneficial, but you can't study it until we reclassify it, and then on and on.
Lee, I'd like to go to you for this one. And sticking with the criminal justice, we talked about this earlier, marijuana arrests disproportionately affect communities of color. So what about those individuals who are already incarcerated on marijuana charges? If this gets legalized, what happens to them?
I mean, that's one of the outstanding questions, even in states that have turned to legalize this, I think has been, what do you do, not just with the people who are currently incarcerated, but what do you do with the people that have felonies on their records because of this?
Right, and it affects their day-to-day
lives. I think California is a pretty good example. So not every ballot referendum that has legalized recreational marijuana has also included criminal justice reforms. California was the only one that did. It's called Prop 64. It was widely known for the fact that it was going to legalize recreational in the state, but what it also did was introduce a lot of criminal justice reform. So I talked to a lot of state's attorneys, people in public defender's offices in California, and basically what they said was once that ballot initiative was passed, they sort of created a triage system where they immediately move to release people from custody who are in custody on these charges and shouldn't be. And now they've just been trying to get the word out to people that are walking around with a felony record for marijuana possession to let them know that they can get that felony dropped down to a misdemeanor and then they can get that misdemeanor expunged.
Well, and Ryan, I think this is a good time to go back to your point earlier. J.B. Pritzker, governor-elect, coming into office, is a proponent, is pro-legalizing recreational marijuana in the state. I believe Mike Madigan might also fall on the pro side. When J.B. has talked about this, has he addressed these concerns that we're talking about?
Yeah, he definitely has. I think it checks a few different political boxes for him, which maybe explains his support for it. So certainly it addresses criminal justice reform. So addressing this issue addresses a lot of the things that Lee has been talking about. Reducing opioid overdoses, making that trade-off even easier than it already is with the new state permissive environment earlier this year. That's two. And then for him, politically, the revenue coming in from legalizing marijuana would give him, you know, that kind of political freedom to actually do some things that previous governors haven't been able to do because they've been kind of hamstrung by state finances.
You're getting on a point that I think a lot of people are very curious about. I know we've gotten some texts even before this evening about this. So a lot of politicians do talk about that legalization of marijuana would allow for the states to tax and regulate it and then therefore bring in a lot more revenue. Could you first put a dollar amount on that? What are they talking about as far as how much money could be coming in the state of Illinois?
So Governor-elect Pritzker has used numbers between like $700 million and $1 billion annually in new tax revenue. A more recent report that came out of the Illinois Economic Policy Institute and the Project for Middle Class Renewal at U of I pegged it at about $525 million annually in new tax revenue for state and local government. So like $500 million for state, $20 million for local. And that is sort of based on going with a tax rate of like 32.5%, something like that. It's similar to what Colorado did. And there's also a possibility of savings for law enforcement. If they're dealing with a lot less of these types of marijuana-involved crimes, you know, what do you save? $18, $20 million annually, something like that. That money, you know, could do a lot of things in Illinois, having $500 million to play with every year.
In terms of the state's finances, what could a number like $525 million do for us in a state that, let's be honest, historically not great, fiscally speaking?
Well, the I have not heard that, but that is good to know.
Oh, I'm glad that I could break that down.
So I think more interesting than the fight over whether or not marijuana will be legalized is, okay, if it is, what happens to the money? And that certainly will be the dominant, I think, discussion point in Springfield if it does come up in 2019 like we expect it to. So the overall state budget is like $37 billion in terms of general funds. So think of $500 million in that kind of context. The new school funding formula that passed last year and started, you know, that money has started to roll, that produced an additional $350 million for K-12 schools. So think of that, we kind of thought of that as a nice new chunk of change that came in. That was $350 million, so this may be more than that, not all going to schools. But I like to think of things in terms of higher education. So, I mean, I sort of work in a higher education environment. It was big news when the state approved a new $25 million scholarship program for Illinois students recently. A small piece of the money could go to something like that, and that would, you know, potentially have an impact. But you can also make the argument you just got to dump all the money toward unpaid bills and pension obligations.
So as we wrap up, I want to hear from each of you. We can start with Lee. So we're going to obviously be following this issue as we go into 2019. So what are the biggest questions that you have as we head into that new year?
One thing that I wasn't able to touch on in this discussion is this sort of issue of equity in the marijuana industry. That has become a big topic of discussion and actually a topic of legislation, again, in California, to increase minority and also people who are low income, their participation in the marijuana marketplace, because historically those are the people who have been hurt by the criminalization of marijuana. So I am very curious to see if that discussion happens here in Illinois the way that it has happened on the coasts. I'm also very interested to see whether or not any sort of recreational marijuana legislation also includes criminal justice reforms to deal with the records that people may have and also the individuals who may be incarcerated currently for it.
For me, it's probably, in addition to how the revenue is going to get split up, it's how friendly is the program going to be to tourism? How friendly would the legislation be? Would it allow tourists who cross state lines to have less marijuana than a state resident? Would there be restrictions on where you can smoke it? Like in your hotel room, is that cool? Or is there going to be, like, are hotels going to set up spaces on the streets and parks? Like, how friendly are they going to make this thing to visitors? Because there will be visitors, especially for the first, it will be the visitors.
I have questions, and I'm wanting to learn more just about the marketing side of this, because for any business to be profitable, they need to increase users. I mean, they need to make sales. So, you know, from a public health perspective, that's a concern you'll hear from people that, you know, because it'll increase either use or frequency, or that they'll, you know, aggressively market the way that, you know, alcohol and tobacco industries have done. And, you know, these companies, you know, alcohol and tobacco have been found to make a lot of their profits from users who have serious addiction issues. That's been demonstrated. And, you know, a Department of Revenue study from Colorado from a few years ago found that in Colorado, almost 90% of the demand for marijuana was going to like the 30% of the heaviest pot users there. So it's just concerns about how this might fuel addiction.
That was Christine Herman, Lee Gaines, and Ryan Dunham, all Central Illinois reporters who have been following this issue in some way or another. We also got a lot of questions via texting that evening. And if you're interested in following this issue more closely, you can join the Illinois Newsroom's text newsletter called Weed Watchers. You'll get a text every few weeks with links to new public media reporting on this issue. You can also send your own questions to reporters to help guide the discussion. To do this, text WATCH to 217-394-5765. Again, text WATCH to 217-394-5765. I'm Liz Westfield, and coming up, we're going to be talking about Rookie Magazine and what it's meant to its readers. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thank you for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. To our Gen X and Gen Y listeners out there, what were you reading as a teenager? Maybe you were a Cosmo quiz queen like myself, or perhaps 17 or Sassy magazine were among your favorites. Well, millennials grew up with a different kind of teen magazine, Rookie Mag. Back in 2011, Rookie was founded by then 15-year-old and Oak Park, Illinois native Tavi Gevinson. She's now a successful writer and actress, but at the time, she was a new generation's It Girl, and Rookie was the It magazine. Written and edited by young people, for young people, Rookie tackled everything from friendships, relationships, and sex to music, fashion, and identity. And through it all, Rookie remained unapologetically teen. Last week, Tavi announced that Rookie would be ending after 7 years of publication. Tons of readers responded, and we put out a call for voicemails to share their thoughts. This is Janaea from Chicago talking about her experience reading Rookie.
I discovered Rookie in high school, and I went to a conservative Christian school and had no other real exposure to feminism or teenagers speaking for themselves and sharing their own voice. Something that I've realized as I've gotten older is the way that conservative communities emphasize adult as the authority on things. And so Rookie was this incredible outlet for me where people my age, like me, were viewed as the authority. And I remembered reading, I think it was an article about Ciara, Beyonce, and like one other musician, and it was all about their powerful feminism. And I remember being so weirded out by it at the time. But I think of it often in like my reaction to that and how I kept reading Rookie anyway and kept learning things and how I became less afraid of people and opinions and voices that were new to me and really learned a lot. Thanks, Tavi. We'll miss you and miss Rookie.
Joining me now on the line is Oak Park native Diamond Sharp, a contributor for Rookie from 2015 to 2017. Her writing has been featured in Pitchfork, The New York Times Magazine, and Vice. Brittany Spanos is also with us from New York, originally from the Chicago suburbs. Brittany began with Rookie when she was just 21, and today she writes Rolling Stone. Also joining us is Upasna Barath, a former contributor with Rookie and host of the video series Upasna Asks. She's a senior at North Central College in Naperville. Upasna, Diamond, Brittany, welcome to each of you, and thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And
for having me.
Brittany, I want to start with you. So you started writing for Rookie when you were just 21, and I believe your first piece was about your identity, especially about your family and music. So can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I had been wanting to write about how my family's music taste, how they were all kind of really obsessive about the artists that they loved and also about my biracial identity. And I wasn't really sure where to pitch that or even how to write about that. I had never written a personal essay for publication before. And I mean, Rookie just was so accepting with wanting to help formulate that idea, wanting to help me best express this feeling that I'd always had about how my music taste and my biracial identity really felt so intrinsic to me and the way I grew up, and having a place like Rookie and having the type of editors like Jessica Hopper and Anahid Alani, who were amazing to work with on it, really formulate that as a young writer, as someone who was just starting to write for more public spaces, was incredible.
And how did you come to find Rookie?
Rookie debuted when I was just starting college. I was a late teen. And I I just remember seeing it being shared online by friends from high school who, you know, were still at my high school. And so they were starting to read it and share it a little bit more. And so that was kind of my first exposure to it. And just as a young writer, I just started to pay attention more to it. And a lot of the writers I loved were contributing to Rookie early on. So it was a really just incredible space from the get-go.
And Diamond, you started writing for Rookie in your mid-20s, so you probably had a little more experience reading other teen magazines before you started writing for one. So what types of things were you reading as a teenager, and how did that influence you?
So as a teen, I was reading Girl.com, G-U-R-L.com, which they had a book, and they had like these web pages on the back end. I also was reading Teen Vogue, came out, I think, when I was a first year, a second year of high school, so maybe 05. Elle Girl, there were a lot of teen, like, additions to, I guess, adult magazines at the time in the early aughts. So that's what I was reading.
And how do you think those differed from Rookie?
Looking back on it, I think that Rookie is probably most similar to Girl. Girl was very kind of hard-hitting and thinking about having real conversations about sex and relationships and feminism. I think some of the more mainstream ones were a bit more careful and a little bit more, they didn't really engage with hard topics.
And Upasana, you were a teenager right when Rookie was starting. So how did you get involved?
So I had been following Rookie on Twitter, and at the same time, I was writing a blog. It was my senior year of high school, and I started writing a blog, and I had the URL in my Twitter bio, and I retweeted something from Rookie, and then Tavi DM'd me and told me she had read my blog, and wow. She emailed me, and that's basically how I got started.
And you also have a video series for them, and you actually filmed your first Upasana ask in your dorm room when you were just 19. So can you describe what you wanted to accomplish with this series?
So with Upasana asks, I was actually articulating a lot of thoughts I'd always had in my head for the first time ever. So all of the videos on Rookie basically are videos of me talking about something for the first time.
Go ahead.
What I wanted out of that was to kind of build upon the Rookie community that I was always established, and kind of find girls that were feeling the things that I was feeling and show them a face and give them a voice that was tangible and that they could just like see and watch and relate to.
Well, and I do think you are very relatable, and you probably get asked about this first episode a lot, and it may be something you need to watch to fully appreciate, but basically you're sitting in your dorm room, you're describing a dental dam that you got from your roommate, and at the end of the video you pull out a bag of chips and you reflect on the benefits and drawbacks of that particular piece of latex, and I want to play that clip first.
Look, I know that dental dams are like a really good way to avoid, you know, getting or spreading STIs, but, I mean, my mom's right. You can just get dinner and leave and have a really good time. And if you can't have that discussion with someone, you know, about, you know, STDs, then you shouldn't be sleeping with them anyway, and you shouldn't be participating in oral sex with them anyway. And even better, if they're super cool about it, you can use the dental dam. And actually, everything will be fine. So, dental dams won. Upasana's mom won. So far, the score is tied.
Again, that is the first episode of the video series Upasana Ask for Rookie Mag. And I think the humor in there mixed with the honesty is really what makes that appealing. And as you said, very relatable and accessible. And that was 3 years ago. So as we listen back, as you look back, how do you feel about those videos?
I feel like those videos are a gift because they're actual evidence of my growth as a teenager and into adulthood now, but also an appreciation of who I was back then and all the things that I was learning about and talking about at such a young age. And I'm really proud of it.
And I think you should be, as all of you should be, because this rookie model is different from most, at least in my opinion, content for young teens and young people created by teens and young people. So, Brittany, what do you think that did for the readers, making it a little bit different than other teen mags?
I mean, I think the, especially with the diversity of voices and experiences and the number of writers and photographers and, you know, just artists that we had working with Rookie, I think a lot of people who weren't seeing themselves represented before were able to find something that they could connect to and that they could really see themselves in, and also know that a lot of life is about learning and about, you know, being able to say, I don't know, to a lot of things, especially just, you know, you're always, when you're a teen, you're looking at people who are more experienced than you or more knowledgeable or just in general more mature or whatever you kind of want to identify with. But I think for a lot of people, they were looking to writers like us and editors and the people that were on Rookie Daily who were learning too and who were able to express that and able to find ways to say, like, here's something that I don't know about or that I'm still learning about myself, about culture, about the world at large. And I think, I know for myself as a reader, being able to see people kind of working through and learning openly through the way that they wrote and through the way that they express themselves artistically and visually, that was really special.
Well, and Brittany, your first piece for Rookie talks about your racial identity. And as you mentioned, you believe Rookie did a good job of acknowledging differences in identities and intersectionalities and things of that nature. Did you have people reach out to you, or do you know if anyone else who is writing from various perspectives got readers reaching out and saying, thank you for writing that, or I learned so much, or anything like that?
I loved the Rookie comment and reader community. I mean, it was, there's no place else on the internet that's like that. And I remember getting so many messages, and I had already, you know, I was kind of like starting to cut my teeth in the music writing world. And those comments are just kind of brutal sometimes. And a lot of just like older dudes being angry about rock music. And so the Rookie comment community, I mean, I was so scared when that piece published, and I remember getting so many messages and so much love. And, you know, there were other biracial readers who were sharing their experiences of kind of learning and parsing their own mixed identity and however it was for them and however they grew up. And it was just, I mean, it was so incredible. I think that was something I did not expect at all. And the emails that I got and the just like the comments on the actual website and the tweets and everything, it was such a great outpouring of love. And I had never experienced that as a writer before.
And I also wanted to play another voicemail from you from a different perspective. This is Jan from Normal, Illinois.
I'm not part of the demographics for Rookie, but I do teach young adult literature at Illinois State University, and I have found Rookie, the website, and the Rookie yearbooks to be one of the best sources of first-person narratives, memoirs by teenagers, and I regularly use them in my classes. It seems to me they're brilliant, and if you want to have an understanding of your high school students, Rookie was the place to go. The one essay in particular I think was absolutely brilliant was Tavi's letter for the December 2013 Brief History of Forever, and it describes what it is to be a teenager better than any other essay I've ever read, and I would recommend that every parent, teacher, read this essay.
So, Diamond, I want to get your initial reactions to Jan's comments there.
You know, I just kind of always amazed by, you know, who's reading and sharing Rookie's work. I think that sharing Rookie's work with teens and young adults is important. That's why I enjoyed editing Rookie. That's why I enjoyed bringing in writing and art and whatnot from young writers. I think it's important, and I think, you know, those comments are ring true.
And do you think, I'll go to Upasna for this, as you're experiencing Rookie coming to an end, do you think Rookie will continue to have this lasting effect on speaking to the teenage experience?
I definitely think so. I think so many people grew up with Rookie and were inspired by Rookie. I mean, even on Instagram, a lot of readers connected with me and they later became contributors themselves. So I really think that Rookie encouraged creative expression and everyone in the community. And I think that has a lasting impact for everyone who read and contributed, and also probably parents as well who kind of got involved with the Rookie community as well.
Well, sadly, that is all the time we have for today. We've been talking about a teen magazine called Rookie with former contributors Brittany Spanos, Upazda Barath, and Diamond Sharp. I want to thank each of you for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I want to thank you for listening today.